Welcome everyone to today's interview with David Buckland and Andrew Hewson and myself, Dorothy Rowe. And we're going to be discussing the topic of the awakening process in the context of the natural way in which the awakening process occurs, and the integration between experience and understanding and the physiology, both from the angle of meditative practices and natural awakening experiences versus the use of hallucinogenic drugs. So thanks for being with us. It should be interesting. All right. Both David and Andrew have established themselves as experts in this area and have worked with many, many people on the path of awakening. And I feel very lucky to have you guys here and that we're going to get to have this time together. So thanks for being with me, guys.
Thank you, Dorothy.
Yeah. Nice to chat.
Yeah. All right. So it's a very popular time for hallucinogenic drugs. And it's clear that a lot of people are turning in that direction in order to have experiences which expand the range of understanding of what reality is. And to honor that, it's expansion of consciousness is an important facet of the awakening process, and expansion or refinement of perception is also.
Yeah.
Do either of you guys want to comment on that?
Well, one of the things that's really important to understand about awakening is that it's not actually an experience. It's a shift in being, a shift in our recognition of who we are. That's why it's sometimes we call self-realization, for example, realizing the capital S self, the Atman, within initially. And so there can be a tendency in some spiritual circles to kind of chase experiences, to do things that can get us, you know, flashy experiences and give us signs of progress or interesting or entertaining kinds of experiences. But in many ways, those things actually can be a detriment, because when you put a strong stress, a really strong experience onto the physiology, have a distorted experience of some kind of reality. I mean, it shifts, you know, hallucinogenics can give you a shift in your perception of reality, but that's usually very distorted. And those kinds of things can actually become impediments, because they can cause energetic fog in the physiology and sometimes cause side effects that have a lasting effect on your experience of just day-to-day life.
It reminds me a little bit of like a man in a cave in the darkness, right? And he wants to, the difference between gradually moving toward the opening of the cave and getting used to the light, or taking him out in the full sunlight and just tearing off the blindfold. That if you come out and you have a big flashy experience of the light, it can be very overwhelming to the nervous system, and the integration time isn't there.
Mm-hmm. There can be, no, it's useful, because some people just have a very, very quiet shift when they wake up, when they shift to the self, and there isn't a lot of experiential content. And sometimes people have lots of flashy experiences with the shift. But it's important to understand the distinction between the experiences, the purification that can come with it, which may trigger experiences or they may interrelate, and the awakening itself. Because the awakening itself is behind all that content. Because experiences and purification are content, whereas awakening is awakening to who we are behind all the content, more deeply within.
I still feel that the element of integration is really important.
Oh, yes. So there's the actual shift, and then you have to integrate that with your day-to-day life. Yeah, that comes after that, yeah.
Right. And so if the method of awakening integrates or has yoked to it? Because are we talking, David, about awakening as like an expansion of consciousness then? Expansion of consciousness, right? That stabilizes?
Yes, in a sense. It depends, but again, it depends on the style of the shift. Because some people experience a sense of expanding from being this small me, this little self, into being this cosmic, unbounded self. Right. But that's just one style of this way we subjectively experience that shift. And there are people who, for example, have a devotional surrender, or they may have a sense of ego death into a sense of no self or emptiness, or they may have a sense of ego death into a fullness. And it's the same space of infinite consciousness, but just perceived in different ways. That relates to refinement that you touched on earlier.
And are there certain characteristics that kind of run across those different types of awakening experience? Like, yes. Common, like if you, in other words, like, for example, I'm thinking like refined perception, for example. Awakening comes this way, you still get it, or that way, you still get it, or that way.
Yeah, I've come to see the shift in awakening as a shift in consciousness, whereas refinement is a process in the mechanism experience of that. And so they're interrelated, but they're somewhat distinct processes. And so some people can have a very clear awakening with a lot of refined perception, where their feeling or visual senses are seeing some of the process taking place, whereas other people they can have more of a kind of an oozing shift, where they're kind of just through their practice and so on, they just gradually shift until one day it's unmistakable, but there is no distinct so they can maybe point to some point, but it can be more a much more gradual thing. But they're kind of like the masculine and feminine, or the Shiva and the Shakti kinds of processes, those shifts in consciousness versus those that refinement of perception. And some people have a lot of refined perception, like you see with a lot of energy healers and so on. They've cultured that inner perception and healing the emotion and opening the heart. Some people have a more development on the consciousness side, and where it tends to be a drier, flatter kind of approach, the detached witness and so on. And the ideal from my perspective is a balance of those two things. Of course, there's some refinement of perception, but not getting too caught up in the experiences that can create and get it too identified with those. But also some that development of consciousness beyond the content, beyond the forms and phenomena, and into who the actual or the actual shift itself behind all that. So the kind of two come hand in hand. And so there's an integration process for both.
And do you see a difference between the path that the person takes? Because you laid out about four or more different paths right at the beginning, yeah, versus the type of experience that they have as they go into awakening.
Yeah, there's quite a few different variables. One of them, they have the idea of the yogas or path in Eastern philosophy, where you have someone who's more inclined to be devoted and has more a path of the heart. And then there's people with more of a strong intellect, not quite to be mistaken with a strong mind. That's really, really common in the West. and speaking from experience. And then there's like the karma yogi who is through the path of action and perception. They learn through just living life in many ways, but of course accompanied by meditation or something similar to help culture that enlivened consciousness within. But each of those are just kind of a favoring. I remember early on reading about it and thinking that, oh, you're supposed to be on this path or you're on that path. Really, it's kind of like many other things. It's more of a mixture. You know, someone can be more dominantly heart-oriented or with the path of the intellect, but but there's always a bit of a mixture. Like within the stages themselves, there is a stage where the heart opens, for example, and that's inherently a more devotional stage, even for someone who's more intellectually inclined. And then they have the Raja Yoga path that they talk about in India, the Yoga Sutra, and so on, talks about, and that's kind of blends aspects of each of them for, again, a more balanced and complete process.
Andrew, how does that tie in with your experience?
Yeah, I would say that is definitely what I recognize is taking place as well. Even if there's not an exposure to that type of information, like whether or not someone knows about different yogas or has come from a particular tradition, that as consciousness is realizing itself in a field status, recognizing itself as being infinite, then there's going to be some underlying qualitative consistency that's accompanied by those subtle nuances in the way that it's being held subjectively. But I would also say that, at different levels of the recognition of reality as self, or as what appears to be the absence of the self with a capital S, that could be recognized as a level or a phase of development. So it's not totally contingent upon just the way that we're seeing it, but from what I can see, that regardless of the subtle nuances in the perspective, that these qualitative channels, we might say, of recognizing reality as an infinite field, are going to be present throughout the majority or all of the shifts that take place. And the way that we contextualize those, varies. But basically, if someone is familiar with the process as it has taken place, within themselves, then they can recognize where someone is at and say, this is kind of the level that you're, or the stage that you're at. And in David's book, he lays that out very, very clearly, and then also offers different ways in which the shifts can be seen, but then recognizes that there's going to be an underlying consistency regardless of the way that it's being held.
Right.
And we can see that in different subjective accounts of what's unfolding.
Mm. Yeah, that kind of ties in to that. I was sort of aiming at that. I was wondering about that, like, what is that consistency? From the angle of energy healing, there's this premise that what's really happening is that infinite source of self, that infinite field of qualityless being, is essentially experiencing itself as and through us. So we are that. And everyone has different, like, varying degrees of being aware that that's the reality that's going on, is that being is awakening to its own nature through and as us. And my experience with a healing process is that when people fall ill, that the body, in its infinite wisdom, as an expression of divine being, is using itself as a metaphor, all the systems of the bodies as metaphors, to help guide the awareness of the indwelling self into that particular area that needs to transform at that moment in order to support a greater level of integration of being through that vehicle of that person, through the vehicle of that person. So
yes,
that's how energy healing that I'm seeing is sort of tying into what you guys said.
Definitely. I feel that the healing that starts to naturally take place, if there's really an openness and a willingness, really adds to that refinement aspect that David was talking about, that those are very closely linked.
Yes.
If there's an absence of the healing, then there's probably going to be an absence of the refinement. Hmm. And the more that, you know, that's, that material is being healed within ourselves, then the more that we're kind of turning up the dimmer switch on our capacity to really tune in to a lot of these subtler layers of creation, which in enlightenment is recognized to be what I am. So as David was saying, it's not like there's someone that has refined perception of something else. I'm recognizing myself and all of the mechanics of myself and dynamics of myself. And that also, from what's been recognized here, shifts according to what level of reality is recognized. So what the closer that our identity is to pure divinity, then the more divinized, we might say, those dynamics and mechanics are going to become. So.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, more than just being like an infinite consciousness, it's interesting because, you know, you recognize that it's obviously divine because it's infinite, but it's not recognized to be divine in the way that it is when you really start to recognize the fundamental pure divinity. So there's something that's qualitatively different the closer that we are to that recognition. And it's like a radiance and a brilliance and an overwhelming power and love starts to contextualize everything.
Oh.
And even right now, as these words are being spoken, you know, that's the radiance and the brilliance is shining forth. So in regards to integration, you know, being relatively functional from this phase of development probably would not have been the case earlier on if you were shot into something that's kind of comparable to what's being spoken from now. You might have just been real quiet and not able to, you know, be in the world, but not of it, you know?
Yeah. And Dorothy, you often use the talk about the layers like this. And
oh, yeah.
Just about adding the you know, consciousness down at the bottom to the, you know, physical and emotional experience of the world. It's about all those layers in between. It's about waking up to the whole thing. And to the whole thing as myself, and then more.
Yeah, I have that chart. I'll just pop that up here. Here we go. So, and of course, my chair is a little bit in the way, but let's see how that works out. So, I'm glad that you mentioned that, David, because actually, I was thinking about this, particularly these two deeper layers when Andrew was talking. He was saying there's this, you know, point of expansion where you identify with the silence, but then it's almost like there's another layer of the silence that's even more pure. How did you say that, Andrew? It was like you said it was like more, even more pure or something like that. And I was thinking that could be in here, in this relationship, because these two deepest layers of this chart, the two deepest layers here, represent the unmanifest field of being, but one is being completely, like in its most, such a pure state, the resting silence. Oh, I don't have their Vedic terms, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Silence is just, it doesn't even identify at all with the whole field of diversity at all. Whereas
it's important to note, Dorothy, that these are the dynamics of consciousness, how consciousness comes out of itself and creates these layers from deep silence up, you know, into liveliness and so on, up into the visible world, the layers of creation. But there's also the dynamics that, well, dynamics is the wrong word. There's also layers, but you get beyond that.
Oh.
So, because Brahman is effectively beyond that, and then pure divinity is beyond that. So
like Brahman, my understanding was Brahman is infinity in all of that, so that every particle of creation breathes infinity, and that infinity is understood on its own terms within every single particle of creation, and yet it only is that, it's only Brahman.
Right. But it's like Brahman is that, and it's transcendent to consciousness.
And it's transcendent to consciousness.
Yeah. And so
okay.
And so it's also almost like the silence, the pure silence is kind of how it first tends to show up for people. And indeed people can wake up to being infinite silence as one of the characteristics. And then as the perception refines, or if there has been enough refined perception already, the liveliness in the silence becomes more aware, alert, or conscious, whatever.
What's interesting about that, David, is that the way that it unfolded here was actually the opposite of that. So it was the dynamic presence that was recognized first as self here, and all of the formations. And so there was a disappearance of space and objectivity in relationship to the more feminine presence, the dynamism, but the background silence was not fully recognized yet. And then later that shone forth almost as if it were the witness of the field of conscious presence, or the more dynamic level of the field.
Right. But it is very common for people to first wake up to the silence and then to wake up to the liveliness. That's a more typical style. But yeah, it's like
that is a more typical style, yes.
Yeah.
And then David, you're saying that beyond all that is Brahman, and then beyond all that is, what was something else?
Parabrahman or pure divinity.
Pure divinity.
Yeah.
And the question...
That's pretty advanced though.
Yeah. The question is, if we think of consciousness as consciousness, like, so that's some aspect of awareness, pure perception, pure consciousness, pure awareness, like that, then Brahman being beyond that, and that
consciousness... inclusive of it.
Pardon?
And inclusive of it.
Yes. Yes. Uh-huh. Yes. Yes. I was going to say... consciousness we understand as a byproduct of the fact that we exist, right? Because we're in our bodies and we're living in this world. And the first thing when we settle into dynamic silence, and the silence, that's what we notice. And I'm thinking that that's a byproduct of the filter, the filtration system. That's what we notice first. In other words, Andrew said he had it, he reversed his experience of these two from what's the common, but there could be people who reverse even further and they experience Brahman first and then they get to all this.
I want to ask David a question. When you say that that's the more common shift, or are you typically referring to those that have like a daily practice of transcendence?
Yeah, it's more a degree of refinement. One of the things they talk about in Ayurveda and some of the philosophies in India is that development of consciousness and development of clarity or purity, sattva, that refinement, related to refinement, is cumulative through lifetimes. So different people are born with different levels of development of each.
Mm.
And so some people come in with a lot of refinement already present, and some people don't. And so you can start a transcending practice and meditate and develop that refinement, but you're picking up from where you began, so to speak, I guess is the way. So some people have that refinement and they're more likely to experience the process more clearly and liveliness and fullness and various kinds of characteristics will be there, whereas other people will be much less inclined to that. And from what I'm seeing, it's more common for people to wake up to the silence aspect, and then the liveliness comes after that.
Mm-hmm.
And how does that relate to the refinement? So they're waking up to the silence first or the dynamism first? How is it?
Well, if there's more refinement, they're going to be more aware of these layers that you have up in the process as they're stepping down through the transcending process and diving into the silence and then back out again. They're going to be more aware of those layers going down.
I have to laugh as you're saying that, because I was thinking as you were describing it, well, I started at a very crude level in this lifetime, so.
Sometimes, though, we have this karmic dynamic to work out first. Like, we kind of work through a bunch of karma, and then everything starts to flower.
Yes, yes, yes,
yes. But I think it might be in reference to what you were saying earlier, as far as the style of the pathway and how that kind of translates into the unfoldment, is that what took place here just spontaneously was just an all-encompassing devotion where, you know, I mean, it was on its hands and knees just at, you know, public restrooms every chance it got. It could not, praying, just gratitude, appreciation, and just an intense love for divinity, just pure bhakti. So I think that probably had, you know, was already present, obviously, from karmically, but also translates into the way that it unfolds. And there wasn't really an established practice of meditation at the time. I mean, meditation was occurring, but it wasn't something that was really consistent and, you know, had been occurring for a long time.
Yeah. Beautiful. Beautiful. So my work is focused on how all of that integrates and what's the integration process. Because, you know, for a long time I was thinking, well, the awakening process is about expansion of consciousness and, you know, becoming more and more attuned, essentially, or in that state of Brahman, in more and more awaken that. But then I realized that we're always coming from the point of the physiology. And of course, as an energy healer, there's a lot about that. And I'm thinking that the mechanics of the integration are essential to understand in order to support the awakening in the most intelligent manner, like how one, like you were saying, Andrew, like once you realized that dynamism of divinity was there, it was just like every action, every breath you took was like a prayer of gratitude and adoration for the divine. And so there was a shift in the behavior that kind of like came in and supported the process then speeding up and happening faster and better like that. Is that about right?
Yeah, I would say that it preceded the actual shift as well, but it's not an event. I don't ever see it as an event. Like David was saying earlier, although we can recognize probably, you know, an experience that is within the process, that experience will quickly be recontextualized as things are unfolding, so that it's not seen as some sort of a, you know, a special significant event that took, you know, that was in time. And oftentimes in certain teachings nowadays, particularly those that are at least calling themselves non-dual teachings, there's a heavy emphasis on awakening as an event.
Right.
And I think that that's a great limitation, because it puts people on this mode of kind of looking for a particular happening. And as David was saying earlier, sometimes it's very, very quiet, you know, and you may not even really recognize that you're already living from a more spacious level.
And yes, one of the things to note about that, I've been present for a lot of people waking up over the years, and one of the things that often surprises people is how ordinary and normal it is, that they were looking for some special big thing and or some flash or some profound realization, but it was actually just a little click, you know, just a shift in perspective. And so that can be really quiet and go right by and not even get noticed when it happens sometimes, and until later when there's more integration and so on, as Dorothy was talking about. And then it just begins to, you realize that things are not the same anymore and the action is different. It's, I'm not the doer anymore. It's just happening and so on, all these various characteristics.
That's right. And the reason that I say that it's not an event is because it doesn't have an ending. So we could probably recognize, you know, the point where there was a clear shift in seeing ourselves as the field and that being kind of unwavering, but there's no ending to it. So we can't call it an event. You know, it's like started here and ended there and there's my awakening or whatever. Right. And I think that oftentimes that's the way that it's interpreted. So it puts us, you know, it puts the seeker or the seeking that's appearing within the experiencing kind of on a mode of looking for something that it's used to in its mode of perception.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. A lot of people also, their surprise is that, how didn't I get this before? Because it's right. So simple. They're looking for some complicated or just something. And
that, it's, that could be also partly because when it happens, the soul realizes, oh, I had it all along.
Yes.
It's always been here.
That's right.
I just didn't see.
Right, but I agree. But there also is that idea in a lot of non-dual circles too, that there is one shift, and you know, and that's self-realization, and that's the whole thing. And that has been true to some extent of a lot of teachers. They've had that initial shift, and so that's what they teach. Mm-hmm. But if you actually look at the older texts and, you know, the Shankara and the origins of non-duality, they talk about a great deal more than that.
Mm. Yes, and in the, I've been exploring, because I have clients who have encouraged me to explore some of the experiences of the people who are taking hallucinogenic drugs. And a lot of these people are saying that they have multiple shifts. It's a shift, and then it's another shift, and it's another shift like that.
But is that a shift in perspective, or is that an actual shift in, I mean, what, there was a, I remember there was a story that was somewhat famous in TM circles at one time about this guy who woke up and had his God consciousness stage and then his unity stage all in a short period of time. And he described it to the teacher, and that kind of became this famous, you know, people that wrote it down and sending around emails every so often about this famous thing. But when I actually finally read his book, it turned out he had these openings during a drug trip, and he spent the rest of his life trying to get it back.
Mm-hmm. Well, that brings us back to the point of integration as far as I'm concerned.
Yes.
That it's really, really easy to have a flashy opening. Like pretty much anybody can do that. But to stabilize in the nervous system, and that means the creation of neural pathways and restructuring of blood flow, and it's a lot of like delicate...
The way the brain works. Is
yeah, there's a lot of delicate changes that have to take place, and those changes, the body takes its time. The body has its ways of doing things. And so, you know, if a person has a... flashy experience in a night or 24 hours or something, the amount of time it takes for the body to work with that process is dependent upon how natural the process is.
Yes.
It comes on in this sort of delicate way where the opening is happening and the adjustment is taking place and the opening is happening and the adjustment is taking place, then one can go through an opening like that and be literally transformed. But if one's, you know, taking the drug and going at it for an all-nighter or something like that, the body, a lot of those delicate changes, they just require a certain amount of
subtlety,
life force, I would say, to attend to those changes in order to support the permanence of that experience. Does that make sense?
Yeah, we're also talking again about those layers too. And so it's not about just waking up in consciousness, down at the bottom there, but bringing that wakefulness forward through all the layers. And as you, the higher the layer in terms of the model there, the more dense it is and the slower it takes for that to catch up to the process.
Yes.
If you then, you know, stick something in there where you, you know, stick it with a cattle prod kind of thing, you can kind of go zap and, you know, may get some flashy experiences out of it. But what is the long-term effect of that? Does it just kind of create more fog and stress? Or is it refining that process? Because the whole refinement process is driven by this very refined, Ayurveda again talks about this, the very refined chemistry is not quite the right word. It's like pre-chemical, but just on that subtle layer. And there's this chemistry that takes place in the physiology that refines these subtler bodies and allows them to support that very subtle layer of consciousness in the physiology, and all the little aspects, the mechanisms, the cells, all these little things have to adjust to this, and using a sledgehammer isn't the greatest way to do that.
I think too, probably there's also a lot of self-delusion that's present in these kinds of supposed awakenings that take place through psychedelic use, and really it's the identification with the ego that's saying that it had a shift, and basing that, you know, that assumption on the shift in perception, but there wasn't a real fundamental shift in identity, you know?
Yeah, it's like that famous Yogananda quote about somebody pressuring, there was a reporter pressuring him to tell them if he was enlightened or not. And he responded something, to paraphrase, anybody who says they're enlightened isn't. And I kind of, you get a little bit of blowback from talking about this sometimes from people saying similar kinds of things, but it's more as who is it, you know, what is it that is awake? Because, you know, I had this goal for decades that I wanted to become enlightened, but it's not I that becomes enlightened. It's the self that wakes up to itself within and shines out through the other layers. And so it's the attachment to the I, the thinking that I'm going to get something out of this, or I'm going to have an experience, or I'm going to become enlightened. That's actually the barrier to it, because you're trying to become it as a me, where you actually leave that behind. And, you know, I mentioned earlier with the styles, where some people can actually have a sense of ego death when they wake up. And it's not really the ego that dies, it's the attachment to the ego that lets go. And that's pretty fundamental in there. So it's a pretty major shift in the sense of self.
Yeah, I was under the impression with ego that it's weakness in the ego that stops the process, and that it actually, when the ego expands to the cosmic level of, there's a being is expanding into that space, which is ego, and ego takes on that, then it opens, and it's actually a strong ego. I mean, people who have that experience are able to be very decisive and very effective in the world. And
yeah, there is a kind of a cosmic value of the ego, a universal value that also can become identified with. That's kind of associated with the unity stage. Mm. And when we recognize that not only is that self within, but it underlies everything in the world around us as well. So the subject and object come together in one wholeness. But in that context, there can be, you know, we can get caught up in the cosmic values of various things. There's a cosmic value even of the physiology.
And
it's easy to get caught in any kind of experience. It can be a trap. And so one of the challenges people have with the Brahman shift, for example, is they have to let that go. to shift beyond Atman, beyond the cosmic self. That's why it's called the self, and step beyond that into Brahman. And some people, it's like surrendering their enlightenment. It can be challenging for people.
Oh, interesting. If they're attachments, yeah. It can.
Yeah.
When I talked about the, I usually refer to the human ego when I'm using that term, but in the way that I kind of put forth the shifts in consciousness and beyond, I contextualize it so that it's a movement in our sense of I, so that our sense of I is no longer associated with the content and form of the experiencing, but becomes associated with the field in which the content and form is emerging. And then there's different levels where our I can be recognized at. And of course, the highest recognition of I is pure divinity, which demarcates an identification with divinity itself, so that I'm not a part of divinity, I'm not an aspect of divinity, but it doesn't have anything to do with the personality per se. The personality is more what is reflecting the nature of that identification.
Yeah, it's like a function.
Yes.
Now, it's important here to note that there's kind of what described as these long cycles of time. And we're, from that context of what they call the yugas, we're rising. There's debate about calculation of that too. But essentially what's happening at the moment is we're rising out of a darker age in consciousness. And during that darker age, Shankara and other teachers arose, and Shankara revived the monastic tradition. And because it had been pretty much lost at that point, and it was also a very valuable in a darker age to have a more monastic emphasis, to get out of the mud of the world. But we're in a rising age now, and the vast majority of people are householders. Their life is here to live through relationship and being in the world and supporting their family and community and so on, and yet there's still a really strong renunciate emphasis in a lot of teachings in non-duality circles and so on like that. And some of it's quite subtle, but it can create these conflicts if you're trying to live your life as a renunciate while working and having a relationship and so on like that. So, yeah, it creates a lot of, and they can be subtle, but it's important to recognize that enlightenment doesn't come through for most people through withdrawing from the world, except in those brief periods of time, like in meditation or something like that. We step out, we step back in, like you were talking about, Dorothy, the integration. There's that just day-to-day through our practice, we touch into source, and then we bring it out of the world and we integrate that. And gradually, and some of the scientific research I've seen shows that even after 8 months, we begin to carry some of that silence forward. After 8 months of regular meditation, we carry some of that silence forward into our daily activity.
It's beautiful.
Thank you for mentioning that, David. I laughed because I've, you know, run up against that that apparent dilemma so many times. And what I've really come to recognize is that actually daily life is conducive to moving into higher stages of development if it is, you know, approached correctly.
Yes.
Because oftentimes in a renunciate pathway, there's a lot of material that's just being kind of set on in our, you know, kind of stone Buddha posture. And you can reach a certain recognition and feel relatively complete, you know, to the previous mode of experience. But that doesn't mean that there's been a resolution of that material. And a lot of the seeds have already sprouted. So it's there. Ooh, sorry.
Yeah, you get into that whole thing of what some people call bypassing too. I've been surprised to realize that you know, these powerful spiritual practices like meditation and stuff can be kind of co-opted and used as a way to escape from your day-to-day experience. And indeed, that's what some people are doing with, by going to ashrams and withdrawing from the world in some kind of ways, rather than dealing with their stuff or dealing with their life problems. They're pulling away from the world as an avoidance. And that really doesn't help the spiritual path particularly well. And there's a lot of energy modeling in the West for bypassing. So there's a lot of people doing it in different kinds of ways.
Yeah, it seems as if the culture really actually supports people with myriad of ways to escape the things that they don't want to deal with.
Yes.
And it doesn't really support people to move forward and to kind of address them. And it's definitely part of the whole energy healing process is coming to realize that even the darkest, most insidious or malefic experiences that come up they're actually part of the evolutionary process. And when those things come up, if we can broaden perspective enough to see the evolutionary value in whatever that concern or problem or illness or whatever, then that shift allows one to gain mastery over that particular quality of energy that they're dealing with in that problem. Right. And those qualities of energy, even though we think of them sometimes as like negative or something, or sort of destructive laws of nature or something like that, they actually do provide a platform of energy to support the transformation process. Because life, the human experience, has this potential to embrace totality, which means it includes everything.
Yes.
Right.
You have to dissolve that shadow in order to bring in the light.
Yeah, and my experience isn't even so much dissolving it. It's more like managing it, sort of. You understand that the negativity is there and it's part of reality. And if you approach it from the angle of its place in the evolutionary process, then it starts to serve evolution. Even if it's negative, it still serves evolution. And when you've got both the negative energies and the positive energies both serving evolution, it's a way to really speed up that process.
Yes. And the perspective too, that all of that, you know, supposedly negative material can actually be converted so that it becomes an enlivened presence and is supportive of the process. So this, you know, directly ties into moving through contextual shifts and consciousness to the refinement value, because, you know, as our identity shifts into infinity, then what that does is it kind of creates some space where a lot of the material that was being held down through our identification is allowed to come up. And this has a multiplicity of hell. So in each shift, I'm creating a subtler space, you might say, which allows for previously unseen material to come up to the surface. And it comes up to the surface in daily life. So a lot of times, you know, it's in the experiencing that's appearing within consciousness that all of these things are being recognized. Ignition, what takes place, there's the opportunity for our attention to move into that deeply and to hold it and to allow for the intelligence to resolve it in the way that it needs to be resolved. And so as that takes place, it's not just like if we shine light into a dark room, it just automatically is seen to be light. I feel that it's almost like darkness shines forth, not just as light, but light that has remembered that it's light. It's like, because it passed into that apparent darkness, it's not just becoming light, but it's awakened light. It's realized light. It's that potential that has apparently fragmented itself and is now back in a recognition of its reality. And that is totally supportive of being, you know, being able to perceive some subtler levels of creation.
Beautiful. Yes, I also I've experienced that these contractions require a lot of energy to keep contracted. we're keeping that lid on, you know, all this time. When we finally start to see them and let the lid off and let the steam out, so to speak, it frees up all this energy, lifts all these shadows, and so on. So we become clearer, as you mentioned, a refined perception. There's more energy because we don't have to keep it clamped down anymore, and so on. You know, there's huge benefits in terms of quality of life.
Yeah, and powerful. One of my experiences is that the people who come who are suffering most from having lost their personal power or given it away have done so because they were afraid of looking at the shadow side of themselves, essentially. You know, afraid of looking at the darkness. And so they're more willing to just kind of roll over and just say, well, you some authority figure will take care of this for me, and I'm not gonna do it. And the problem is the thing is that there's a lot of energy in the emotion, for example, emotions like anger, fear. There's a lot of energy in them. And when that energy is directed towards enhancing the evolutionary process, it can really, and that means with delicacy and speaking the sweet truth, you know, tenderness, but like owning it, then that supports, it opens up a broader, I'd say, spectrum of range of behaviors and thoughts and activities that one can perform that helps to move the whole evolutionary process forward.
In the pathway that I sort of prescribe, one of the methodologies that we use is a daily inventory process. So to have, you know, some section of your day portioned out where you sit down and simply allow for consciousness to recontextualize a lot of the content observed in daily life. And what this does is also offer another layer of clarity, so that if there is something that isn't really being recognized, you know, in the spontaneous experiencing that's taking place, through actually sitting down and investigating it, it can be seen more clearly. And then as that's seen, what takes place is there's a freedom from the concealment that's taking place of the content. So it's almost like one gets excited about discovering these aspects of ourself that are, you know, conditional, that were being repressed or suppressed, and there's drawing to go deeper. So it's not something that we're afraid of, but it's actually something that's being equated with freedom itself. And beautiful. you can bypass a lot of the tendencies to identify personally with a certain recognition of reality and fall into sort of a spiritual ego trap in more of a personalized sense, where one's taking credit for something, or to claim enlightenment in such a way that it puts you in a position of superiority and puts everyone else that's not enlightened as being inferior, of course. So those kind of things are very important understanding of, as because oftentimes I feel that the cases of teachers that we see that are engaging in activities that are considered to be unethical are arising from a lack of investigation, and also from a lack of understanding about the various pitfalls that can arise on the pathway.
Right.
Just because they were cultured in a more renunciate style.
Right. Yeah. Because a lot of those renunciate traditions don't talk about healing the heart or energy healing, you know, these kinds of things. It's just not on the table. It's kind of seen as part of the illusion or whatever.
Yeah, there are a lot of things that aren't talked about. I mean, there are a lot of paths that are very disciplined, and the range of the tape, you know, it's only so big.
One thing, just to, as a mention of the illusion, yeah, that's one thing I found fascinating studying Shankara. He talked about what they call the three gunas. There are these three subtle qualities whose mixture leads to all forms and phenomena we experience. And when there tends to be a dominant energy in our experience, we tend to, and by the way we approach things, whether when we're resisting and so on, like many people do in the West, then there's a culture in what's called tamas, or inertia. And so when tamas is dominant, then we experience the world as solid and real. The outside world is as solid and real. As we purify and get things moving a little bit and let things go some, then the rajas guna starts to become dominant. And rajas is activity and fire, movement. And this can be used for transformation. It's very, very useful for the transforming process. When rajas becomes dominant, then we start to see the world as illusory. And it's kind of the way as Maya, the way it's often described, which basically means that seeing the world as illusion isn't a sign of enlightenment. It's actually a sign of culturing the shift in the gunas. And then it can be to come with it, but it's a somewhat separate process. And then as sattva becomes dominant, purity or clarity, then the world comes to be seen as lila, the divine play, the expression of divinity. And that directly associates with the refinement of perception. Because, you know, when you see the, for example, we spoke earlier about with self-realization, when you wake up, you realize that you're not doing the doing. Ego had been claiming these actions of the body, but actually there's a process that are taking place that are causing the doing to take place. And so there's a detachment from action and doing that can take place in there. And the degree of that varies somewhat with the shift, the dominance of it. But the question can then arise, so what is doing the doing? And that's where the refinement of perception comes in, when you start to become aware of those more subtle layers, and you can become aware of how consciousness is fundamental, and the world arises from that. And you speak extensively during your webinars, Dorothy, about the mechanics of some of those subtle levels and how that process takes place.
Yeah, but the definitely the main focus is that divine stroke of creation, which has established a field here, what we call the earth plane, our physical reality earth plane, that has such boundaries and limitations in it that even for divinity, it's like a little bit of a process for divinity to fully embody it. Yeah. It slows it down. There are enough boundaries and limitations in the earth plane that divinity gets to play as it comes in. As you mentioned, the play of divinity comes in like that. And it's beautiful because it slows down that integrative process. And as it slows down, it puts it under the spotlight. It puts it under the microscope so we can see all the fine details of how divinity itself is embodying into a field of limitations and boundaries and physicality that's here present. And it's very interesting.
It's a very important point too, because otherwise it all happens all at once. There is no process of time. There has to be a process for it to be experienced and for that experience to unfold. And so there's what they call in India dharma, which often is translated as purpose, but it actually means that which sustains. And essentially the idea is it's actions we can perform that are help support our life, our family, our community, our, you know, through work and so on, that sustain sustain the world and sustain ourselves. And it's through that process that we're able to have this experience and able to be the vehicle for the divine to bring it all out. Because if it all happens in a flash, then all the details are lost. Whereas if it can happen in this slower process, then all the details can be noticed and brought out. And so it quite changes your perspective of your life when you see your life as a mechanism for the divine to know itself.
Okay. Yeah, well, it's obviously very important at some level of the field of divinity itself that awareness is present with that process. Otherwise, it wouldn't go like that. And it's reminding me of that other chart that I made, because I kind of think of Rajas also as being one of the, I'll bring up that chart briefly, since I did make it for our talk today, that the Tamas is the destructive energy. You were saying that people identify more with the relative, is more identified
with... But Rajas can also be burn. It when it's moving towards inertia, because it's moving, can be moving towards sattva or can be moving towards inertia. And right. Then moving towards inertia, it can burn. And so it's like, again, yeah, it's like this balance thing again. Moving in the right direction so that you're purifying and transforming rather than destroying.
Yes. Oh, I see. Moving in the direction so that you're purifying and transforming rather than destroying.
And growing, as opposed to, because basically if you look at nature, it's like entropy, things are falling apart and turning to dust, or they're growing and with increasing order and complexity and
yeah, and definitely the purifying and transforming aspect is the other side of that destructive energy. Oh boy, there it goes. Yeah.
And also, David, I like how on your website you have that quote from the Upanishads that says that the truth is covered in gold.
Yeah, the face of truth is covered.
The face of truth is covered in gold.
Yeah,
and that's really relevant to maybe touch on as well, just as far as how, you know, sattva can be the golden handcuffs.
Yeah.
And we can get kind of attached to that. To that clarity, I see it so many. I have so many examples of those that I meet that have been on the spiritual path for some time, and are very familiar with, you know, their tradition, and are in a very nice space. They are oftentimes the ones that are the most limited in their degree of rightness to really recognize their self beyond the form. It's not always the case, because I think it's also said that the cultivation of sattva is, you know, supportive of awakening, but there is that catch 22.
Yes. And it's often, you know, I've seen that quote translated various ways, like it's face of truth is covered by a disc of gold, which doesn't really make any sense. But when you recognize that gold, sattva, has these gunas I was talking about, have color. And when you experience them on the subtle levels, you can see them. You can actually see the dynamics of the gunas taking place. And the sattva guna has that quality of being gold. And yes, exactly. So it's still part of the forms and phenomena, and so you know, the sattvic experiences can be very beautiful and uplifting and entangling. I also know examples of people who have many beautiful experiences and paint them and write about them and all this, but then they get kind of drawn into that and don't go beyond that into what's where those are coming from.
Thanks for touching on that. I appreciate it.
Yeah, beautiful. Beautiful. And I guess that ties us back a little bit to that original seed of the theme for this meeting, which was the fascination of taking drugs to produce a particular type of, it gets the nervous system into a particular mode, so it produces a particular type of experience. But the experience itself isn't
Awake. But does that experience burn?
Yeah, it burns. That's so interesting. So interesting. All right.
As far as integration is concerned, see, I've sort of laid it out. Five-phase developmental process, where there's a recognition of a level of reality beyond what we are currently taking ourselves to be. And there's a transcendence of the dominance of the previous recognition of reality. There's a stabilization of our identification at that level. Then there's a unification of the apparent discrepancies that are present through the three phases. And then there's an integration of that into the lifetime.
Right.
In order for the unification to take place, we have to see the material. So if you have cancer and you don't know that it's there, it's much more likely to kill you than if it's found early on.
Right.
So part of the process means that we have to face all of that that's within ourselves, and through facing it, recognizing it, on some level taking ownership of it, then we have the capacity for it to be unified. And as it's unified, it's that process where that darkness is remembering that it's light. So it's that enlivened light, that awakened light. And that is totally transformative and allows for the integration to be something that is very full and very complete, and not something that's kind of, you know, fragmented and halfway there. So that
we can we say, Andrew, that it makes it practical, like applicable, like you can use it then, right?
Yes.
One of the symptoms, for example, I've noticed is the mind, because experience is happening in the mind. It has words and makes a story about it, whatever, like that. But when you have a transcendent experience, the mind doesn't have language for that. Mm-hmm. It's wordless. But as that is able to be integrated, the mind catches up after a little bit of time, and then words can come. So that's kind of a symptom of integration.
Oh, that's nice. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's so nice. I think one of the most important points that came out today was the fact that the awakening process has this potential to manifest in a wide range of different varieties and levels of experience for people, you know, for the most part, probably just based on the fundamental makeup of the individual, where they're, as you mentioned, like what they bring to this life from past incarnations and so forth. So that's going to determine.
Yeah, and that's really important too, because one of the things that happens is people hear about awakening happening in a certain way from their teacher, and then if it doesn't happen that way for them, they don't understand what's going on, or they get into some kind of conflict.
They think they're doing it wrong or something.
Yeah.
Andrew?
And not compare. So if we're comparing, then we're limiting a real recognition. Affirming, we're more of underlying qualitative consistencies. So I'm not looking for the differences, which can kind of cultivate doubt and different things and can be disruptive in the emergence. Mm-hmm. But I'm looking to confirm what's being recognized, and also having a degree of flexibility with, we use different language.
Yeah, it's one of the issues I've had with my writing is that on the one hand, it's really valuable for people to have some context and understand that one is not just one awakening, and you know, and there are different styles of experience and so on. But on the other hand, then you get these people who basically come and collect concepts and more supposed tos, and yeah, it's hard to avoid that. But yeah.
It reminds me of the process of learning any new skill or ability. In my life, I have gone through many different art forms. And what I notice is in the beginning, the student is just intellectually understanding from the teacher what, you know, if you're playing a musical instrument, say, I was going to say throwing a piece of a pottery on a wheel or something, but say playing a musical instrument, you know, this is A, B, and this is A, and this is G, like that, and they learn. But then there comes a point where they've repeated that process so many times that the mind transcends. When they play B, it transcends. When they play A, it transcends. When they play G. And then at that point, awareness reaches this place where A is infinity manifest and G is infinity manifest. And at that point, each nuance of the new experience takes on a life of its own, essentially, is appreciated in terms of its infinite value. And that's when the shift occurs between being a beginner in that particular art form to being more like a master or advanced student in that art form. Hmm. Wow. I think that ties in.
I want to make one more point. Just the more full that this becomes here, the importance of healing is just turned up more and more and more. And if you would have talked to me at a certain point in this process, I would have said, "What are you talking about? Like, I don't need, there's nothing to heal, you know?" I can laugh now at the naivete of that, but that's the way that it seemed. But really, it's so far off this, and if we can just have the capacity to really see that this is a process, and this is something that has an infinite deepness to it, and that if we can be with the material as it arises in a way that is compassionate and loving, and also really utilizes the attention in the way that you talk about, Dorothy, then we are going to tap into such a greater level of reality.
Right. And on the contrast, if you don't, and that stuff is arising, you can get into these big internal and battles and act out crap on everybody, and
that's right.
Wow, it's beautiful. Thank you for that sweetness, Andrew. I really appreciate your validation of the usefulness of the energy healing process in all of this, and definitely. I definitely feel that working with and through the human nervous system supports our ability to recognize and move past all sorts of illusion. That's what a lot of what the energy healing process, I think, is about, is the body brings up. It's like, you need to focus here now, because this is where... It's like a house with dirty rooms, right? The dirtiest room is the one where it becomes like the sensitive spot on the body that reacts when you lose a night's sleep, you don't get enough sleep, or you eat something inappropriate or whatever. And so that awareness goes in there, and it establishes that which is beyond the physical in that space of the physiology, and that area uplifts to its full potential, becomes healthy, and it becomes usable in a way that it wasn't before. And so it's very sweet, and I think it is good to sort of cross-reference with the different systems, because there's a little something that each one can add. So,
and it also translates into our collective room. We all have our own little rooms and dirty rooms, but we all are in a bigger room that we kind of share in. And to the extent that we have the capacity it's on in our dirty rooms and process that material, is to the extent that the larger room can benefit from that. And it also makes it easier for the aspects of ourself that are present in this larger room to move through that as well.
Yeah, and it also opens up those larger rooms to us, and so we can clean in the larger rooms as well.
Mm-hmm.
Very well put.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful, guys. Well, I appreciate that we got a chance to explore a larger room tonight. Andrew said it's like shining the flashlight into into that big room that was sitting there like a mystery. So, you know, I hope everyone who's watching tonight got a chance to a little glimpse of some of the broader perspective that's here, that we're all, our ability, David and Dorothy and Andrew's ability to present this is a byproduct of everybody who's watching's ability to expand their own awareness into broader ranges of experience and to embody that silent source of creation even more perfectly. So I hope everybody really enjoyed this and that you get a lot out of it. If you listen to it again, you probably get even more. I'll have to listen to it again. But thank you, dear ones, for being my guests on this show. It's such a privilege and honor to have you. And I hope we get a chance to do it again.
Thanks, Dorothy.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Thank you, Dorothy.
Bye.